calling me Larry.
Hello, Larry.
Hats off to Larry.
Larry. Fucking Larry.
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 Larry. Larry, get into bed now.
You're on Larry. Larry.
Is there no sweeter sound than that of your own name? Buried in cheers and applause. There is not. It's mid-September, and in Southern California, that means church carnivals and chili cook-offs. Why now? I have no idea. It's not like shitty weather is going to preclude those activities later in the year. Maybe they just figure that's a good time to siphon some jing out of people's pockets before Halloween and Thanksgiving and Christmas take precedence. So many tributaries flow downstream from your kids. You'd be amazed. There's truly no way to measure how the birth of a kid flips people's so-called lifestyle. Now, there's a bullshit word invented by marketing drones. We get a life, one life. Whether and how much style we imbue it with is up to us. But the kid thing, I get this question again and again and again from people about to become parents. What's the toughest thing about being a father? Well, it's not the sleep you'll lose waking up to feed and change your kid's diaper. It's not the money you'll blow and all kinds of crap, from diapers to bassinets to cribs and strollers and diaper genies and formula and toys and ass wipe warmers and oh hell, it just goes on forever. I never resented any of those chores or expenditures. Because believe me, when you look at your kid for the first time, somehow they just rewire you from what do I want to? What do they want? How does that happen? I have no idea. So years 1 to 3 might be heaven or hell, depending on the kid. My first kid slept like a Kodiak in winter, sometimes 20, 21 hours a day. I thought she had narcolepsy. Ask the pediatrician what was wrong with her. His answer, nothing. What's wrong with you? That you're not enjoying this amazing gift, a low-maintenance infant. He was no chooch. He was an old guy who had seen and done shitloads, more than your humble host, so my wife and I heeded his advice, and we actually altered our lifestyle very little. We still went out to dinner, a lot. We'd have my kid in one of those car carrier things, and it was like having a plastic doll. We'd eat, drink, and be merry, and the baby would sleep. Over music, over noise, over anything. There was a retro Mexican joint we liked in Sherman Oaks. You know, red leather banquettes and margaritas you could bathe in. And one night we went over there, sat at the bar, and ordered drinks while we waited for a table, and the bartender looks at me and tells me we'll have to sit someplace else. And I ask him why, and he looks at my 10-month-old sleeping in the car seat thing, and he tells me he can't serve children at the bar. And I laugh and tell him she's not drinking, she's sleeping. And then, a few years later, my second daughter was born and was the opposite of her older sister. She was awake 22 or 23 hours a day and almost killed me. In the same year, I got pneumonia twice, and I never get sick. But I didn't love her any less. That's what kids do to you. So none of these things were really awful or make being a parent difficult. What kids do to you that is awful is they force you into socializing with people you'd rather garrote than speak to. Complete assholes you'd avoid like a virus. People with whom you have nothing in common except a kid of the same age in the same school. And so you find yourself seated on ass-punishing folding chairs in school auditoriums or on soccer fields or at softball games making small talk with idiots. That's painful. That's difficult. That's really the toughest thing about being a dad. People sometimes have heard that I do a podcast and they'll ask me, what's your podcast about? And I answer, it's about 20, 25 minutes on Tuesday and half that long on Sunday. And then they make a face and they say,
No, really, what's it about?
And I say, well, go to thatlarryshow.com and you'll know, probably in less than 2 or 3 minutes, whether it's for you or not. And then they still have a face on, a face of dissatisfaction, chagrin, because everybody wants every fucking thing wrapped up and summarized neatly for them, like a 30-second commercial, or a tweet, or a logline on a Netflix listing. And then they'll ask, well, is it sports? Is it politics? What guest do you have on? Then when I tell them it's not sports or politics, and there are no guests, they get really flummoxed. Kind of annoyed, really. Then they'll ask, well, what's it like? And I tell them, it's like chicken. Tastes like chicken. That usually ends the conversation. Of course, you know what this show is about, and often listeners write to me with problems and questions, whatever's bugging them, and we try to help them figure it out. A quick detour for words. You know I'm a word freak in somewhere, probably in either the bullshit realm of corporate America or the bullshit realm of academia. People stopped having problems and started having issues. Some idiot shrink or dean or CEO just thought the word problem was too negative. Bullshit. Problems can be solved. Issues? What the fuck is an issue anyway? Over the course of this show, which is now somewhere near 150 episodes, we have helped people tackle quite an array of problems with a remarkable success rate. And if there's one area that seems to bedevil us more than any other, it is predictably affairs of the heart. Seems those cut the deepest and are the slowest to heal. So a listener named Warren wrote to me with a tough one. Here's what he had to say. Larry, I need advice. I feel awful after me and my girlfriend broke up. I broke up with her. And even though it was entirely justified, I still feel like a real piece of shit. She was amazing. She genuinely cared about me. Never even looked at another guy. But a big problem came when she refused to stop getting way too drunk every time she got the chance and forcing me to stay up till 4 in the morning, helping her through her bipolar episodes. One day my dad and I are trying to talk about my own mental health when she starts blowing up my phone about a panic attack. I split up with her once before, and she went and tried to kill herself. I picked her up from the psych ward, and ever since then it's a balance of her taking care of me and me taking care of her. She quickly became extremely overwhelming. It caused me panic attacks, stress, headaches, and anger. My question is, even with all that bad, she did a lot of good for me too. A whole lot of good. What should I do? Signed, Warren. Whoa. This is a tough, tough question, Warren. It's a cocktail made with the most explosive ingredients we have. Booze, bipolar, and the most dangerous thing of all, love. Adding fuel to your emotional fire is a heavy overlay of guilt. It's one thing to break up with someone who is healthy and self-sufficient. But walking away from one with a busted wing, well, that's more gut-wrenching, isn't it? Let's try to break it down to its elements. First, way, way, way too many people get entangled in relationships they shouldn't because two things cloud our judgment like a blast of octopus ink. Love and sex. Both are overpowering. Which kind of brings us back to Granny's advice. Try to be friends with some chick first. That bromide always pissed me off, and it still does. When you meet some pointy vixen who revs your engine to the red line every time you think about her, friendship is the last thing on your mind. Maybe the problem with Granny's advice was it may have been distorted over the centuries. Before we fall in love with someone, it would be wise to try them out as friends. But that seems kind of quaint and silly. But it's not silly to sit quietly at a beach or in the woods or any place devoid of distraction and think about that person, that girl, that lover, and think to yourself, what if I could extract her essence, her personality, from that killer body and beautiful face and transfer it into, say, some unattractive woman, or one of my male pals? Would I hang around with her? Would I want to be with her? Not just for a few laughs or beers, but for a lifetime. Would you put up with a guy friend who consistently called you at 4 a.m. needing a fix for panic attacks? What about the drinking? Drinking is one thing. Getting drunk is something else. Alcoholism. And you're not going to fix that. Hell, AA has been around since 1935 and they haven't figured it out. They don't even know what their own success rate is. Tough to measure because it's anonymous. Drew Pinsky figures it's around 8 to 12%. Estimates run higher, of course, but it is far, far from a guaranteed remedy. But it doesn't matter. Addiction tends to be a lifelong problem. Whatever the therapy, they always say they're in recovery. It's never, I'm cured, is it? I've had a friend for years, good guy, nice guy, give you the shirt off his back, but he cannot handle booze. A couple of times we hung out at clubs listening to kick-ass music, and both times I had to pour him into my car and carry him into his house. Fuck that noise. Who wants to babysit an adult? So whenever I hang with him, it's in a booze-free location. Sure, anyone can overdo it, although I believe you can only get drunk accidentally once. The first time. After that, you have experience and some idea of your own capacity, so getting loaded a second time, that's a choice. So your ex-girlfriend is bipolar, which up until the early 1980s was called manic depression. What was wrong with the term manic depression? Not a fucking thing. Same as saying you have a problem. Asshats who despise honest language just had to fuck with it, even though manic depression was a much more accurate descriptor. Bipolar? Well, planet Earth is bipolar. So are my refrigerator magnets. It's a meaningless and dishonest term. But we live in a sick, fucked-up world of political correctness with phony language to camouflage every goddamn thing, even a variety of mental illness.
That is incorrect terminology.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is emotionally disturbed okay?
Incorrect terminology.
What do you want me to call it?
Behavioral disorder.
Behavioral disorder. Well, that would also describe a toddler who wants to stay up past his bedtime, wouldn't it? But being a suicidal adult with panic attacks is a little more serious than a behavioral disorder, no? But manic depressive sounds so harsh and so serious, doesn't it? Manic is just a few letters away from maniac, and depressive, oh, that's not a happy word either. So rename it bipolar instead, because it sounds so much nicer. Regular listeners know I'm a big fan of the late George Carlin, who is also a sworn enemy of douchebags who use deceptive language. And in his act, he traced how these soft lies actually fuck up our world and deprive those who need help from getting it. Here's what George had to say about these assholes.
Americans have trouble facing the truth, so they invent a kind of a soft language to protect themselves from it. And it gets worse with every generation. For some reason, it just keeps getting worse. I'll give you an example of that. There's a condition in combat, most people know about it. It's when a fighting person's nervous system has been stressed to its absolute peak and maximum, can't take any more input. The nervous system has either snapped or is about to snap. In the First World War, that condition was called shell shock. Simple, honest, direct language. Two syllables, shell shock. Almost sounds like the guns themselves. That was 70 years ago. Then a whole generation went by, and the Second World War came along, and the very same combat condition was called battle fatigue. Four syllables now. Takes a little longer to say. Doesn't seem to hurt as much. Fatigue is a nicer word than shock. Shell shock. Battle fatigue. Then we had the war in Korea, 1950. Madison Avenue was riding high by that time. And the very same combat condition was called operational exhaustion. Hey, we're up to 8 syllables now. And the humanity has been squeezed completely out of the phrase. It's totally sterile now. Operational exhaustion. Sounds like something that might happen to your car. Then, of course, came the war in Vietnam, which has only been over for about 16 or 17 years. And thanks to the lies and deceit surrounding that war, I guess it's no surprise that the very same condition was called post-traumatic stress disorder. Still 8 syllables, but we've added a hyphen. And the pain is completely buried under jargon. Post-traumatic stress disorder. I'll bet you, if we'd have still been calling it shell shock, some of those Vietnam veterans might have gotten the attention they needed at the time. I'll bet you that.
Sorry, Warren, I digressed a bit. So you feel like shit because you've broken up with your girlfriend. But your reasons are totally valid. You are entitled to have a girlfriend, not a patient. You can't live your life on suicide watch or waiting for her next panic attack phone call. You also mentioned that you're having your own mental health problems. Well, like they say in the airplanes, Warren, if the cabin loses pressure, get that oxygen mask over your own face first. You can't help anyone else until you're squared away. So she never looked at another guy. Admirable. And she was good for you in many regards. Also positive aspects of the relationship. But relationships, like a lot of things in life, are rarely black and white or all negative and all positive. Hey, I'm back to bipolar there, aren't I? When I think back on my ex-girlfriends, there was plenty to like or not like about all of them. But what you want to do is find one who is overwhelmingly an asset to you. There's an easy analogy you can keep in mind. I once wanted to buy a house that I really dug. Footsteps to the beach, low maintenance, cool design, the right size, the right price. It was a hell of a deal. I was really in love with it. Before it went to contract, I got an inspector to crawl all over it. And that he did. This guy was, Johnny Thorough. And when he gave me his report, my heart sank. He found asbestos. He found serious termite damage. The heating system was fucked. There were code violations out the ass. Now, at that time, I had a great attorney whose nickname was the Executioner, which was funny because he was the most bland, soft-spoken, and unimposing dude you could imagine. But he earned his nickname in court and from his clients who loved him. I called him on the phone and gave him all the particulars, and he listened carefully. When I finished, I heard him take a deep breath. He asked me what I intended to do. I told him I loved the house, but... And that's where he cut me off. Imagine that. He interrupted me. And here's what he said. But nothing, Larry. As your attorney and your friend, I forbid you from buying that house. It's FWD. I said, front-wheel drive? He said, no. Fraught with difficulty. I laughed out loud and at that instant fell out of love with that house. There's always another house. There's always another girl. And it might not be terribly romantic to evaluate a girlfriend or wife as you would real estate. But in some aspects, you have to. Divorce courts are teeming with romantics, broke and miserable romantics. So how to extricate yourself? Well, if she's not calling you, then do not break the silence. Some people claim they manage to stay friends with exes. I never got that. Unless you have kids with them, what the hell's the point? So if she seems to be at peace without you, and there are no 4 a.m. calls or suicide attempts, keep her in the past and do not so much as glance in the rearview mirror. It will just fuck you up. If you're still in contact with her, I would suggest a swift tapering off of communication. No need to be unkind or abrupt, but do be less and less available. And do not reference her problems. That will open the door to negotiations. Once you do that, she'll promise to get sober, to get psychological help, and she'll never have another panic episode, etc. Your ex needs help, way, way more than you can give. Were she a wife and there were children? For better or worse, death do your part? Well, I'd have a very different prescription for you. But you haven't committed to her, and so you owe her nothing. Lastly, Warren, I have a prescription for you. As you move forward in search of love, and it is not easy, and is the most perilous of searches, because the wrong choices can fuck up your life, try to keep in mind that banging house yours truly fell in and out of love with once he got hip to the FWD factor. The moment you meet the next pointy chick, try to determine up front if she is FWD. And if so, move on, my friend, quickly. Thanks for listening, Warren, and good luck to you. Hey, thanks everyone for hanging with me once again. It's always great to be with you. If you like what you just heard, and you heard it on iTunes, drop us a 5-star review. Helps the show grow. If you'd like to hear more, slide over to thatlarryshow.com and click the subscribe by email button. Doesn't cost a thing and you'll never miss an episode. If you'd like access to a ton of bonus content, signed books, custom recordings, and to the Take No Shit Dojo in the backroom parlor and the deep bench of senseis and the best group of people anywhere, click the Patreon button and join the dojo. Come back and hang with us this weekend for Sinner Sunday. And until then, my friends, whatever new adventure you're about to take, job, major purchase, or romantic, always consider that FWD factor. You'll save yourself a fuck ton of misery. Until Sunday, take no shit.